Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And this, the second part of my recent conversation with Tin Machine co-producer Tim Palmer. In the first part of our chat, Tim reminisced to me about his joining the Tin Machine project, about working in Swiss and Caribbean studios, and how the first Tin Machine album came together under the United States of Reeves Gabrels, Hunt and Tony Sales, and unknown obscure lead singer David Bowie. In this episode, Tin Machine 1 has been released, and the band have scattered across the globe. David's off on a mammoth Sound and Vision tour, a bold statement bidding farewell to his back catalogue, inspired no doubt by the resurgent creativity he's discovered with Tin Machine. Reeves Gabrels is busy in Sydney, visiting sex shops to find the perfect vibrator to freak out his guitar, and laying down tracks which could be used for the next album. Tim himself, meanwhile, is in studios, working with bands such as The Mission, An Emotional Fish, and Pearl Jam. But despite all the distractions, Tin Machine's second album somehow comes together through piecemeal sessions, the ensemble effort of the debut album altered to accommodate Bowie's global schedule, and the results make for a very different prospect. Now signed to Victory Records, the band cut a collection of tough metallic rock bangers and ballads, containing amongst them some of Bowie's finest writing in years. Did it make for a much-loved, critically acclaimed album? Well, you know the answer to that. But, as Leah Cardos and I discussed at length in the previous series of this podcast, there is much to love in Tin Machine 2, and as Tim points out in this conversation, had it been released as a David Bowie solo album, history would have undoubtedly viewed it very differently indeed. Anyway, so that's the backstory. Let's get into the conversation now with the man who was in the studio and brought Tin Machine to life, the Tin Machine himself, Tim Palmer. I remember still when this album came out, there was a huge amount of jubilation. David Bowie back on course.
Yeah.
David Bowie kicks out the jams. How did the reaction hit the group? You know, what was their reaction to the reaction?
I don't know their reaction to it because when we'd finished wrapping up and all the mixing was done, I was back onto other projects and reading the press like you were. And I think that, you know, personally, what did I think? Well, I felt that people would enjoy the fact that it was a break away from the 80s thing and that it was finally something more exciting and a bit more aggressive and stuff like that. But I did feel it was special, and but I did always feel that the idea of presenting the band as a true democracy of you know, this is a band, would never fly. And but they, you know, I understand why David thought that. I mean, each member definitely had their own personality, as you can tell. And the project was a combination of all those people. But the fact is, it's very hard to ignore the fact that David Bowie's your lead singer, isn't it? Let's be honest.
I think the important thing was to make it plain that it was a band and not...
Yeah, the difference being that David doing other tours, people working for you, where we're working together.
Against me.
Again, well, yeah. That also.
I mean, it was initially, like you said, it was the first few reviews were really strong. It was over time that that they faced criticism and started saying the words misstep and that sort of stuff. But if it had come out as a solo record, I think people would have given it more time to love the songs. I always believed that, like food, if you try a new food, they say you've got to try it 20 times or whatever before you get the taste. And when we used to have the traditional path with radio, you'd get a song on a playlist. On a Monday, you might hear a new song on Radio 1 and think, I don't like it. And then by Tuesday, you'd say, it's okay. By Thursday, it's not bad. And by Friday, I quite like that new song from so-and-so. So you need to really, to find the beauty in something, you need to repeatedly listen to things. And people definitely didn't give the albums enough chance like that. They didn't repeatedly listen to them the way that they did for the other albums. Because now, when you look at all the fan groups and stuff like that, people who have taken the time do love it. So it's a shame, really. But it's just part of the way that we listen and we learn has gone. When we would love a single, we would be forced to, not forced, but we would buy an album. And again, you'd love the first track that you bought as the single for about the first 2 weeks. And then the songs that at the beginning, when you first bought the album, that you thought, I'm not sure about that song, inevitably would become your favorite songs.
Absolutely.
How many albums have we got that when you first heard that particular track, you didn't like it, but now it's your favorite?
Yes.
And I do believe that the Tin Machine, you know, didn't get the love it wanted because of people being given the opportunity to hear it as repeatedly as they probably should have done.
Do you think there wasn't that space in the mainstream? Grunge hadn't happened yet, you know, that sort of noisy, squally guitars hadn't really penetrated the mainstream. I remember buying the cassette single of Under the God when it came out.
Mm.
It sounds like, you know, somebody's throwing a pile of bricks at you, you know, it's just loud and heavy. So
especially Under the God,
yeah, that was an interesting choice for the lead-off single.
Yeah, I think, for David and his career path and his artistry, I think it was crucial. I think we had to smash it all up to rebuild and start again in a way. I mean, the albums that came later were all because he got that freedom again. And by enjoying himself, he's rebelling against, you know, being a pop star for the masses. He doesn't want to do that anymore. And he made it very clear. He reclaimed his artistic direction again. And I love that. I guess it reignited his passion for what he does so well. And even if Tin Machine is just remembered for that, I think it's important. I really do.
It's not going to be my last hope, but I'm afraid that it probably will be the last time that I'll be doing these songs. I think after I've done these 25, 30 songs, whatever we decide to do, I won't be doing them ever again.
David.
And yeah. I very much want to continue working the way that I'm working and keep myself excited. There's no point in continually doing songs and reflecting on a past. So.
David.
Lady.
David.
Who have admitted on their latest tour that they're cashing in on their old material? Is this how you see it with the 1990 tour?
They're not in Tin Machine, are they? No. But cashing in on my songs? Are you kidding me? They're great songs. I'm a very good performer.
Do you plan to tour with Tin Machine?
I'll tell you what I feel about that. There's about 15 arena artists worth going to see, and until I can't produce a show that is worth going to see, I won't stop doing shows, you know? And as for cashing in on old songs, that's ridiculous. That's 25 years of my life. Get out of it.
And this tour is like more like a wishing well tour, isn't it?
What do you mean by that?
By people throwing a small coin into the wishing well.
I see.
And wishing a song.
Making a hope, making a wish. Oh, I hope it's a bit more concrete than that, in as much that of all the songs that I'm doing, 20 are songs that have been chosen by the public that are coming to see the show. So I think that in itself is... It enabled me to really do what I really wanted to do, which was to let the audience have its choice on what kind of songs they wanted to hear, and allows me the other four or five to choose my own particular favourites to put in. As it will be the last time I'll ever sing these songs, I think it's been a good thing to do.
So the Norwegian audience can actually vote for the songs that they would like you to play?
Absolutely, and they will certainly be taken into consideration. I must stress that the majority of what we're doing now are from the responses that we initially got in England, America, and the parts of Europe that had the phone system on. If there are any radical developments in the song choices for Scandinavia, I would automatically put in the differences. But I think the seven that we took out of each different continent pretty much sum up what people want to hear.
What is your favorite song?
Last night it was Station to Station, but it depends on the performance. Some nights some songs are better than others, and that changes a lot. And the last night in Berlin, wasn't it? Station to Station was great.
So when you finish this concert, are you going to go back to Tin Machine?
Yeah, we finished recording the album in Australia just before this tour, and that should be released by about the end of this year, and then we'll be going out on the road. And we'll choose the songs.
Yeah, and I think that probably didn't help either, because you're trying to get people to accept this new thing, and at the same time you want to go back and do the other, right? I don't think that helped. Ironically, during that period between the two, I was in, I think I was in Dublin actually, producing in a band called An Emotional Fish. And David called up and he said, look, I'm on the world tour and I've been given the most outstanding contribution to British music at this year's Ivor Novello Awards for 1989. And he said, would you go and collect it for me? Which was a tremendous honor for me. So I said, oh, yeah, I'll do it. And I went to the Ivor Novello Awards and made a bit of a speech about, you know, why it's important to give this award to people like David for the fact that he takes chances and, you know, and all that sort of stuff, all that good stuff. And when I saw David for the next time, I said, look, I've got this award. I've got this solid brass Ivor Novello Award. And he really said, it's okay, I'll get it off you another time. Because he really wasn't about awards. That's not his thing. So next time I mentioned it, he's like, nah, it's okay, you're fine. And he basically said that I could have it in as many words. And look, I'll show it to you, and here it is. And I still have it. Out of all the bits and bobs through my 5 decades in making records, this is my most prized piece of rock and roll memorabilia.
That is fantastic.
I know. You know, I even wrote to, they're doing that exhibition of all David's stuff.
Yes, the V&A.
At the V&A. So I contacted somebody and said, look, tell them if they want to put it in the V&A, I'll lend it to them. You can have a spot in there for it. It's a great thing to have as part
of. Yeah.
No one even bothered writing back, so fine.
It's a wonderful thing to have.
But anyway, I wanted to tell you, while we're talking about on this, before we move on to the second album, just quickly about moving to New York. So we moved to New York and we decide to mix at a studio called Track Record, which was a big solid state Logic console, which is I was much more familiar with. And, you know, the goal wasn't to smooth the record out in any form, but we wanted to keep the raw energy. And David and Reeves wanted me to leave it as instinctive and urgent as possible. But I remember there was one song on I Can't Read. David was particularly happy with the rough mix. And I had some technical things that I wasn't happy with, which, of course, didn't bother him. So he said, look, okay, if you insist, but how about this? I'll give you an hour. So he said, we'll use what you've got after an hour. So I had to mix the song in 1 hour. And it was like, stop.
And you kept to 1 hour. That was it. You had one hour.
Well, yeah, and that was the one. And I love that song so much. I think it's great. There's moments in the second verse where he sings the harmony of the money goes to money heaven, and there's harmony on it. And I said to David at the time, really reminds me, don't know why, of Inchworm by Danny Kaye from the the Hans Christian Andersen.
Yes.
And that's what I was about to say. And he said to me, that's one of my favorite songs too. And we bonded over that little nugget for a minute. But yeah, for me, being a 26-year-old guy working in New York City, mixing a record with David Bowie on it. I know it's Tin Machine, but it had David Bowie on it. And his friends would be popping in, like Brian Eno, and Iggy stopped by, and Yoko Ono used to pop in and sit and hang. And she brought Sean down, and Sean was a young lad at the time. And they asked me if I was using the back booth because Sean wanted to have a guitar lesson. Could we use that booth? So I would actually go and stand outside the back of this booth, and I could hear Sean learning to play Julia and things like that, about, you know, John's mum and just crazy stuff like that.
Who was teaching him? David?
Just a guitar teacher came in, and they said, can we just use that booth? He's going to, you know, if you're not using it while you're in the studio. So,
guitar teacher was teaching him how to play Julia. That's amazing.
No, it is. It's pretty shocking. But it was just, I was very starstruck by being in New York. And when we finished the record, when we finally finished, they decided to make a 9-song video sampler with Julian Temple. That's right, isn't it? It was Julian. Mm. Yeah. So Julian was going to shoot all these different scenes. And so Hunt and Tony arrived in New York. That was the first time I'd seen them since we were in Nassau. And they said, okay, well, just chop 9 songs together. And that was really challenging to try and edit 9 songs, just go from one straight to another to make it work for the video. But I achieved it. And then they made the video match. And that was a lot of fun. And David's then decided, because of course you can imagine there wasn't really any involvement in any record label. There was nobody looking over at David's shoulder. If they had been, it would probably be different. But they were hoping, the label are all hoping for Let's Dance 2. And as I've said before in other interviews, they got World War 3. They literally all turned up. David said, let's rent some big speakers to make a playback and set it up in the room and we'll make sure it sounds good and make sure it's fucking loud. And I said, okay. So all the suits turn up, all the different people from all the different departments with their wives and girlfriends all hoping to see David Bowie, and I set them up in a sort of half circle and had these big speakers and we cranked it and blew their heads off.
But they hadn't heard anything up to that point. They had no idea what he was doing.
No, they had no idea. And I could definitely sense some concern in that room.
What was the reaction?
Well, they were Americans and trying to be as polite as possible. But you could see looks of concerns and Bell's figures in front of their eyes and worried looks. And it wasn't long after that he left the label, right?
They were getting, I think they were pretty antsy after Never Let Me Down, because, you know, it was like, get back with Niall, get back to doing disco.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't.
Yeah.
And then, you know, sales, I don't think sales were great for Never Let Me Down, but of course, you know, they had to do Glass Spider, so it wasn't, you know, such a disaster. But
yeah.
I just love the idea of these EMI America record executives sitting there hearing, you know, Heaven's in Here, Tin Machine, Crack City.
I know, and right,
you know, having an absolute nightmare. Machine 2. How did it all get up and running for you?
Well, yeah, it's a little bit of a blur, that period, I must say, but I do remember David heading off on the world tour. And at that point, I wasn't even sure whether they were going to make a second record. And then they'd planned some time to go, I don't know whether it was during a break in the world tour. It might actually have been that, but I was asked if I would be interested to go to Sydney and do some recording. And at the time, I was quite busy with quite a few projects in the UK. So weirdly enough, I don't quite know how I did that, but I actually said, no, I think I should stay in London for the time being. And if it's possible, I'd love to work with you on the record when you've come back from Australia. So they did agree to that, and they went ahead and recorded, I think, at 301 Studios and recorded a bunch of songs. And Reeves brought all the tapes back and they reached out again and I was able to work with Reeves. And it was a very different dynamic because obviously the chaos of the live band and all the members being in one room wasn't there at all. It was much more of the sort of setup that I would have had on the albums I was working at in London. I mean, it was myself, Reeves, bunch of his guitars and amps, and these songs, and we would just be speaking to David and he would fly in for a couple of days and do a few bits of vocal and then fly out again because he was busy. He was probably on the world tour actually still.
Yeah, yeah.
So the whole vibe of the second record was very different, and consequently the sound of the whole record was very different too. It gave us the opportunity to start layering sounds and being a little bit more experimental with some of the tones and the loops and things like that. So the fact that the record is more polished or produced is because of the way that it was created, definitely.
Well, this is one of the things that Leah has asked me to ask you about. She says, the strange harmonies of Tin Machine 2, the chords superimposed over other chords, the chords vetted bass lines, it gives the record a remarkably shimmery sound that's beautiful. And she especially mentions tracks like Goodbye Mr. Ed, Amla Pura, You Belong in Rock and Roll. And I think that's kind of testament to what you're saying, you know, an entirely different modus operandi.
Yeah.
Allowed you to build up this much more dynamic soundscape.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Reeves, You Belong in Rock and Roll. Reeves was able to get his box of tricks out with his sex toys. Anything that vibrated could be used against a string to create quite unusual tones. And it's a little bit like there's a thing that you hold over the strings called an e-bow, and the e-bow vibrates and gives you a long sustain. And by using various different sex toys, if you hold them correctly against the pickup, you could get the strings to vibrate and create all sorts of tones. So we were playing around with things like that that take time that we couldn't have done when you're playing with a live band. We looped some drums on that particular song, and You Belong in Rock and Roll, so it gives it a whole different feel. But there's all sorts of stuff going on in that song that as I said, is part of the approach, really. And it was a lot of fun for me, actually. I loved working with Reeves. When we worked on Amla Pura, for example, I was pretty tough on Reeves getting the guitar parts to be spot on. I didn't want any squeaking, and we spent ages getting those guitar parts right, and then he tracked them, and we got a perfect, shimmery sort of acoustic. Watching for movies. Those beautiful harmonics he plays. I mean, these were all done because we could overdub and just get them just so. And it's something I to this day love to do. And when David came in, it was remarkable, actually. I've never seen anyone do anything like this before. He went out to sing a vocal and sang it, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. And I said, that was great. Because, of course, he nails pretty much all the vocals all the time in one go. There's certainly not much piecing together when you're recording David's vocals. In fact, sometimes it's easier for David just to re-sing a whole performance than to try and explain to you which bits he wants to fix.
Oh, I think I read an interview with you where you mentioned that you mentioned to him, oh, something was wrong, but you know, we can just drop it in. He said, no, I'll do it all again.
I'll just do it again, And yes, it was actually easier for him, I think, to just do it again. And anyway, he sang the song and he came in and had a listen and he said, okay, I'll do it again. And I said, why are you doing it again? It's amazing. And he said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to just go out there. I just want to make it sound a bit sadder. And I said, oh, okay, great. How are you going to do that exactly? Just out of interest. Well, how are you going to approach that to do that? And he said, I'm going to sing the vocal just a little flatter. And I'd never seen anyone do that before, and I haven't seen anyone do that since, where he could control his voice to the point of just borderline flat, which gives it a melancholy tone and evokes that whole sadness in the song. And Amla Pura is just a beauty. I love that song. And I've never seen anyone do that.
It's clearly a song that had a deep personal resonance for him because, you know, it's very well known, his love of that part of the world. Right. And I believe his ashes were scattered there. In Bali. And again, I think this speaks to your earlier point. If you took away the Tin Machine name on that record and replaced it with just David Bowie, and this was a new David Bowie record, I think people would, you know, would rate it as one of his all-time great songs.
I think further for what you said, if you took away the name, took the best songs of the two albums, I don't want the live one, forget, I didn't do anything for me, but take the best songs of both albums and made one David Bowie album, that would have definitely been a strong record, that's for sure.
Absolutely. We've talked about You Belong in Rock and Roll. Another exceptional production is Shopping for Girls. Between the dull, cold eyes and the mind unstable, no one over here reads the papers, pal. Between the dull, cold I believe this was a lyric that he really worked on, and that in itself is a very marked contrast to the first album, which was done, you know, pretty much on the hoof. Here's a subject matter which is incredibly bleak.
Yeah.
And the imagery in that song is very vivid, isn't it? The overall sound and the mood, the vibe of it is extraordinary. Do you remember much of that particular track?
I do remember Shopping for Girls well. I mean, the lyrics about sexual exploitation and children and all that stuff is a very... But the actual track itself is just fabulous as well. I mean, the lyrics strong, but the track, Reeves's guitars on that song are really special with the two harmonies playing in the verse on the hammer-ons. It's just... I love it. It's a really cool track. I mean, we were lucky because, as I said, it wasn't like a band thing where we're all together. I was working over quite a few different sessions with Reeves, which gave us the opportunity to go back to things and try new things. And we worked at Pete Townsend's studio, which is called Eel Pie. And then we also worked at a studio that I used to love to work at called Ridge Farm, which is in the countryside in Surrey. And it was the same place that I recorded The Mission's first album, and I mixed the 10 album for Pearl Jam there. So I worked there a lot. And Reeves and I spent some time there. And it was a great opportunity to just try things. Like, I could play a little bit of octave piano. I'm not much of a piano player, and I played some percussion, and Reeves could play acoustic, and then we could mic up his guitars and try different textures and go back to things. And if it wasn't for... The only thing I didn't like about the second album is I think it was a mistake having Hunt sing those two songs. I really do. I mean, I love Hunt as a person and as a player. I mean, he's just got the most incredible groove. I mean, even to this day, people will cite Lust for Life, Iggy Pop, as just like a classic drum track. I mean, he's a monster. And Tony's a wonderful bass player as well. But I don't think that... he should have sung those two songs. If David had sung those two particular songs, I think Stateside and Sorry would have been actually pretty strong. So the songs aren't too bad.
Why do you think those songs ended up on the album?
I don't know. I don't know how that happened. I think it's part of that whole thing about trying to not just be about David and try and feature other aspects of the group, maybe. It certainly wouldn't have been a decision I made, but... that's a weird one, isn't it?
It really is, because they're very different to the other body of songs that we're talking about. You know, these songs which are typically now very layered, built up with Reeves's experimentalism, a very open-minded, collaborative approach. And then these Sorry and Stateside are very sort of conventional by comparison.
Yeah.
Really, you know, I mean, Stateside especially.
Stateside especially, because it's more of a blues jam, isn't it? If David had sung it, it would have fit more on the first record for a start, not the second. Sorry, the actual track is quite, that would have fit in on the second record, I think. That one doesn't sound so separate. There was another song called, I'm sure you've heard it because you're a Bowie fan, but there's a song called It's Tough, which is, you can hear it on YouTube. There's a video of that.
Yeah.
And that song is great. That's a really good one. And that would have been better off than one of these two, I think, personally.
Compounding the mystery is the fact that on Oy Vey Baby, the live album, you get like a, 400-minute long version of Stateside, which, goes on forever. So it wasn't as though the track made it onto the album by accident. You know, they came back for more.
Yeah.
They went back to Stateside again.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to record David a lot of the time with a handheld 57 or a 58 microphone, just because gave him the freedom to move around a little more. And when I first recorded his vocal, I was quite worried that he would have a specific setup that he'd use that he got to know throughout all his early albums. But once again, following on from that original talk we had about what was great about what David did about leaving people to do their thing, was he didn't question that. He just said, great. And he took that microphone, and he was never one of these artists that would be just a pain in the ass to try and get a headphone balance for to sing. Whatever you had, he was fine with it. Because he was a pro, that's why. He could sing, and it was fine. It was wonderful.
There's a lot more singing on this album compared to Tin Machine 1, because we get a number of, you know, David had his voices, you know, he had the growl, he had, you know, the yelp, he had the croon, he had all these wonderful voices, and we're hearing a lot more of those here, which I think also then reflects the increased complexity of the songwriting. You said it on the first album, everything was recorded very fast. Did you find that again on the second album? Did he record his takes fairly swiftly?
The vocals, vocally, I mean, David is more likely to go back to a vocal because he's changed the approach of the lyric, and he's fine-tuned the lyric more than he wants to sing it again because it wasn't right. That part's easy for him, really.
Let's play one song. Come on. We're here. We're rocking. You can't talk.
Stateside.
Come on. Let's do it. Let's do it. Come on. Come on. Let's do it. Are you ready?
Oh, the other thing about that album, which was interesting, I think, worth talking about, is the label at that time was Victory. So it had changed in the label. And there was a guy called Phil Carson, who was the sort of A&R man, who I'd known from my time working with Robert Plant. He was part of the record company when Led Zeppelin was signed, and he was a good friend of Robert's. But he persuaded Victory that they should sign the project. So he was very excited about the record. And I think it was probably him that suggested that they recut One Shot, which is a great song. And really doesn't sound that much different, to be honest. The only difference I'd say is it's definitely a little more sort of refined and 80s, because Hugh Padgham is a wonderful engineer. But everything is very clean and nice. And I think that's the only major difference, really. It was designed as a compromise to Phil to try and get more radio airplay, because they figured having Hugh Padgham's name on it, because he was such a big-time producer at that time, would be a good thing to try and increase radio play, but I don't think it really worked. I was recording, ironically, next door at that point. We were both working at A&M Studios in Hollywood, and I was recording next door, so I would finish my session and go and just sit at the back of the room and watch them re-record the song that I'd already recorded.
It's bizarre, isn't it? I think I told you there was a quote from Reeves talking about the entire Tin Machine experience, and he said their one compromise that they made was re-recording One Shot for Victory. That was it. He said we were uncompromising. That was the one compromise. And then he said what you said. He said, you know, Hugh's a lovely guy. He's a really good guy, good at what he does. But literally, it was a change in the hi-hat pattern.
Uh-huh.
That was it.
Yeah.
You know, he did say, I think I got a slightly better solo on the Padgham version. He said, I just think I put down a better solo there.
Yeah.
But it's a great song.
It is a great song.
It's a fantastic song. might have been the lead-off single, or it was definitely a single, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, Baby Universal was a single at some point, and You Belong in Rock and Roll was the biggest hit on that album. That got to number 33 in the UK, which I was really surprised about. I had a pretty cool video to that one as well. But yeah, I don't know about re-recording. Oh, also, the other thing about this second album was I think that if it had been given a little bit more time and people had spent a little bit more time thinking about how many songs they got, rather than grabbing an outtake from the first album, which was the Roxy cover, If There Was Something, which I really like. And I mean, it's got some of the most crazy guitar solos Reeves ever did on that song. I mean, it's amazing.
I love that
version. I love that aspect of it, but it really belonged on the first record, and you can hear that. And as we said earlier, putting Stateside and Sorry on there as well, it feels like there was sort of like two-thirds or half there, and we needed to get the other half right, and then the whole record would have been really strong. But there's definitely a third that I think could have been improved.
You mentioned there were a lot of tracks left over from the Tin Machine One sessions in Montreux. Obviously, If There Is Something was one of those very early cuts recorded. Is there a huge amount of unheard material from the Tin Machine Two sessions?
Well, I think that that one, it's tough.
It's tough,
the song
yeah.
is tough. I think that was from the second album, right? I think there's the full version of Hammerhead.
Yes.
Which is also from the second, which I think is great, that one too. Hammerhead's a superb rocker. And what's great about the full version, if you ever hear it, it's probably on the internet somewhere, is another one of those examples of what David was talking about. The band kick in and David starts singing, Hunt's flying, Reeves is playing, and Tony had missed it. So he sort of just sits back for about two bars and then joins like in bar three. And it's a terrible error, but it sounds so good. It really sounds like a great rock and roll intro.
And it kind of speeds it all up, the intro, doesn't
it's
it?
Like
they're all tumbling in at different times.
Yeah, I love it. And that was a happy accident, and I'm glad that was kept. It's a shame that they didn't put the full version on the album, actually.
So what happened then? So the album was wrapped up, it was done, it came out. What did you lose touch with Bowie and the Tin Machine guys? What happened after that?
Yeah, after that, I stayed very much in contact with Reeves, particularly Reeves, because I was invited into the project really by Reeves and David. I stayed in contact with Reeves through all these years. I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago where I ask him things and see what he's doing. He's helped me because I do a lot of work for the Academy. He's done some stuff for me for the Recording Academy, for advocacy, for stuff like that. And we're still good mates. And in fact, right after the Tin Machine record, I made another record with The Mission, their third album, and Reeves played some killer guitar on that album. He played on a couple of songs, so that was nice. So he played on some things for me. And even when I was working with Ozzy, he played a solo on a track that I was working on that came out as like a B-side, and Reeves came in and played a killer solo on that. So I've stayed in contact with Reeves very much. David, and I've heard this from other people, when you're working with him, you're very close, and then he goes on his way, and I didn't really stay in touch. I wish I had, but it's just not the way it always works out. When we were working together, I mean, he would literally call you at home to tell you a joke. I mean, it was strange like that. One time, I always love to tell this story because it's one of my favorites, but when we were back in London, I think it was on the first album, and we were back in London, and I get a phone call at my mother-in-law's house. I don't even know how he managed to get the number. And my mother-in-law said, David Bowie's on the phone for you. Okay. So he said, hey, you know, I need to buy a couple of leather jackets. And I know that you're really into all the clothes thing. So He said, do you want to go shopping? Can you take me shopping for a couple of leather jackets? And here I am thinking, well, why would I be showing David Bowie where to get clothes? But at the time, I was very into a shop called Johnson's, the Modern Outfitters. It's La Rocca, and it's on the King's Road. And I used to buy all their tasseled stuff and their crazy rockabilly things and shirts and creepers. And that was my whole thing. And I still have a lot of those outfits. I kept them all. And the Japanese pay a fortune for them, but I've kept all mine. But he could tell that I was into all that stuff. So he figured I'd know a good shop to buy a new leather jacket. So he came and picked me up in a big black town car. And off we went to Kensington Market together and jumped out. And I took him into Johnson's in the Kensington Market. And everyone was looking up. And it was great. And he bought a jacket for his son. And he bought another one for, he was dating that girl, Melissa, at the time.
Yes, yes.
He bought Melissa a jacket. And I've seen a picture of her in the jacket, actually, somewhere. And we had something to eat. And then he dropped me back home. And I took David Bowie shopping.
That's wonderful. That's so wonderful. And it's everyone I'm lucky enough to speak to who worked with him has a similar memory of him in terms of just what a nice guy he was, you know, what an easy person he was to be around.
Yeah.
And I think I'm so happy every time I talk to someone like yourself that's worked with him, and to hear, you know, yet another person say he was fantastic is lovely, because there aren't that many of our heroes around that everybody was genuinely fond of.
That's right.
And was a very likable person.
Absolutely was. Yeah. And I mean, the thing that he was very clever in the way that he sort of, you know, people call him the chameleon or whatever, but when he was with me, he sort of, his accent sort of became a bit more London.
Yeah.
He used to call me Mr. P. But yet when he was talking with Reeves, he would be slightly different. He was very, very clever the way he worked with people. But yeah, he was wonderful to work with. I learned so much from him. And I was very honored and blessed to have had the opportunity, especially so early in my career, to work with David. Yeah.
Well, I think we can, that's a perfect ending. We can leave it there. So, Tim, thank you so much for your time today.
No problem.
I've been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
It's been just great remembering all these stories and talking about those records.
Just the twinkling light of heaven, two reflections on the sparkling water, hand in hand in love with love.
It was such a collaboration of ideas with Tin Machine that everybody had something to throw into the pot. I think for me it was a bit of a relief to sort of kind of get my own way with this solo album, because it's sort of, I instigate everything when I'm doing solo work.
And what is the status right now of Tin Machine?
I guess on running hold. I think Hunt's down in Texas and Austin working with blues bands down there, which he's want to do. Tony's working in LA. Reeves and I are actually going to do a collaboration later on this year. Hopefully, there's a dance troupe called La 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 Human Steps that I'm very fond of. And my favourite troupe in North America, have been for years. And Edward Locke, the choreographer of that group, has worked with me several times on several occasions. I think the best known is a Sound and Vision tour. He can conceptualise that. He's asked me if I will write something for a kind of a ballet for them, or a dance piece for them. So Reeves and I hopefully will collaborate on that. And the studio album, I hope, will be towards the end of this year. We'll go back and do the third album. Fourth album, actually, because we have a live album out this summer.
And that was David Bowie in 1993, reflecting on the status of Tin Machine. Running hold indeed. And of course, before that, it was the wonderful Tim Palmer, and a huge thanks to him for his time and generosity in recalling his work with David and Tin Machine. Thanks also to Leah Cardos for her input and questions for Tim for this episode. And of course, for the intro and outro music. Finally, thanks to you for making it this far and listening to this conversation. And I'm incredibly grateful for your time and for your reactions and feedback. Keep an ear out for another Bowie collaborator coming very soon.
I hope very soon. I always say that, but I really hope I get this one out soon for reasons that will become obvious. But till then, thanks for listening and bye for now.